Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome to today's edition of the show Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Today, a special edition as we bring you our third episode of The Big Conversation Season 3, a live stream show that went out just this last week with N.T. Wright and Douglas Murray. But, well, it's a busy weekend for Unbelievable because the conference is upon us. Unbelievable, the Conference 2021, sponsored by Harvesters Ministries. And if you're listening on Friday or indeed Saturday morning, you're still in time to register for the conference. Unbelievable.live is the place to go. I know that over 2,000 people have already done that and will be joining us at some point in the day. It's great to know that we'll be having people from all over the world at this year's conference. But if you'd like to book your place, unbelievable.live, going to be a great day with N.T. Wright, Tom Holland, Sean and Josh McDowell, Claire Williams, Ruth Jackson and myself hosting as well. But right now, let's get into today's edition of the show, our big conversation recorded just recently as a live stream. We've got a survey which we'd love you to complete if possible, just a number of multi-choice questions, very quick to get through. The link is with today's programme, okay? We'd love to know what you made of today's show with the survey. And don't forget, you can find more from Unbelievable, updates, bonus content and more of these great shows if you register at thebigconversation.show. And today on the programme, we're talking about identity, myth and miracles and asking, can we find a story to live by in a post-Christian world? We do live in a post-Christian culture and many secularists have welcomed the fading of the West Christian identity. But the question is, what is it being replaced by? And how should we address what many believe is a growing meaning and identity crisis in the West? We're going to be asking, can Christianity still make sense of the modern world? And to help us do that, N.T. Wright is a senior research fellow at Wycliffe Hall at the University of Oxford. He's the former Bishop of Durham and the author of numerous books, including his latest, Broken Signposts: How Christianity Makes Sense of the World. Our other guest is Douglas Murray. He's associate editor of The Spectator magazine and author of books including The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race and Identity. And during the course of the conversation, we're going to be making time for your questions as well. So we'll have some of those towards the end of today's show. If you've got a question, whether you're watching via our YouTube channel or on one of the many Facebook pages who are sharing tonight's video, then do feel free to put a question in the chat, in the comments, and we've got a team who are going to be looking out for those and sending them through. And we hope to be able to ask as many of those as we can towards the end of the programme today. Well, thank you so much, Douglas and Tom, for joining me on the show today. I think this is the first time we've had you both together for a conversation, though I'm sure you're both aware of each other a little. Douglas, have you bumped into Tom's work before coming on the show tonight?
I certainly have, and read parts of it over the years, and actually have recently been reading at the recommendation of many people his excellent biography of Paul, which I've been immersed in. And so, yes, very much so.
And, fantastic. And Tom, you actually have both sort of had a little bit of a to and fro in the pages of The Spectator, actually, in as much as I know that you recently responded to an article by Douglas, didn't you?
Yes. I've read Douglas in The Spectator frequently, and I've now read his book, The Madness of Crowds, as well, with great enjoyment and a rather scary interest, because it's quite a dystopian vision. But the article in The Spectator did to me what articles sometimes do, which made me pace around the house for half the day thinking, I really have to write something about this, and thinking, no, don't be silly, you haven't got time, don't do it. And eventually the worm in my head turned into rather quick prose. I was thinking of an article, but it turned into a letter, but I hope it was stimulating anyway.
Well, I certainly did find it stimulating, and we'll maybe come to that issue in a moment's time. Yeah. But before we get to that, Douglas, how are you? How have you been coping with the past COVID year? How have things been?
Like everyone, you know, it's a bleak time in lots of ways, and has things that are salvageable in it. I've had far more time to read than I normally do. I've very much enjoyed that. I've had the opportunity to do a lot of thinking, a lot of writing. I said at the beginning of the pandemic that, in a way, those of us who are writers are rather well set up for it. To be a writer is to be able to deal with solitude, and that, indeed, you must have solitude. So we're rather practiced at it. But nevertheless, nothing can prepare you for something as strange as the era we've been through. And I suppose, you know, not leap straight in, but I do think that certainly my readings back over history and plagues in history seem to bear out one of the things I feel at the moment, which is that they have a disorientating effect on the civilizations across which they roam. All sorts of strange things come out of the woodwork, strange beliefs, strange fears, things you didn't know were there. And I think that's very much the case in our society and across the world in the last year, as much as it has been in history.
Yeah.
Yes, and as Justin knows, I wrote a little book last year called God and the Pandemic. The publishers put a subtitle, something like The Coronavirus and Its Aftermath, hoping that the pandemic would be over in a month or two, mm-hmm. but that the book would still sell. And now it's a bit, well, we're still waiting for the aftermath mm-hmm. a year later. Yeah. But that was really in response precisely to what Douglas has just said, that particularly in America, but also in other parts of the world, the sudden arrival of this pandemic and all that it's meant has produced all sorts of apocalyptic speculations, and is this a sign of the end of the world, and or does this mean that God is punishing us for some specific wrongdoing or whatever? And it came as a shock to many people that there have been pandemics and plagues and so on over history reasonably frequently. And it's just that in the last century, we in the West have been protected from major disease like this. So we were kind of unprepared. I see it as like a sort of wartime conditions, in that everything is different and we just have to get through it. And when we look back, there will be all sorts of things where we say, oh, what a pity that had to happen, or this came about, or whatever. So I think there's a lot of navigation and negotiation still to be done.
It does present an interesting context within which to be having today's conversation. We're asking, can we find a story to live by in a post-Christian world? And I wonder if we could start with your own story, Douglas. For those who perhaps haven't come across you before or don't know this particular aspect of your life, you did make claim to a faith yourself at one time. So tell us a little bit about that and what happened along the way.
Like most people from Britain, I'm not that comfortable about speaking about myself. I know we live in an era where everyone volunteers up their personal story first. I tend to always want to do it last, if at all. It's not a secret. That having been said, I was born and brought up a Christian, as a believing Christian, from I think most of my life, including through my adult life, and I'm now in I suppose a self-confessedly conflicted, complex situation of being, among other things, an uncomfortable agnostic who recognizes the values and the virtues that the Christian faith has brought. I think I sort of laid out how I think our civilization, our culture has got to the stage that it is at the moment and its current uncomfortable relationship with faith. I tried to lay that out in The Strange Death of Europe. I still believe what I wrote there was accurate as a diagnosis of the era. But it's and it's a very uncomfortable, as I say, position that some like me is in, because I say, you know, there has been a period of rejection of faith, particularly from what in our lifetimes has been known as the New Atheist movement, which made claims that were self-confessedly wrong. That, for instance, actually, I think as a late friend of both Tom Wright's and mine, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks once said, you know, that the claim that, for instance, morality was obvious was obviously wrong. The claim that basic ethics that we might share are self-evident is self-evidently not the case. One doesn't have to be an ethicist to know that. You just need to travel. You just need to read, look and listen, and to know that's the case. So there has, in my view, I think we spoke about this before, Justin, that there has, in my view, been an interesting movement in recent years, which I think Tom Holland, who you mentioned earlier, was certainly an example of people saying, actually, if we go back and look at this, what we have and what we like does have roots in this, in the Christian story. Now, the follow-on question from there, I suppose, is, well, what do we do about it? And I think that a great failing of our time has been the tendency to talk past each other on this. The religious tend to say, well, it's easy. You just have to believe. If you recognize these virtues and values, then believe. And it doesn't take into account the fact that very many people today, it is harder than that for all sorts of reasons we could go into. But I would just make one other observation, which is that even outside of faith, I have an added discomfort, which is the discomfort of a non-believer who is disappointed by the behavior of the believing church. Now, many people think that's paradoxical, but it isn't at all. I not only was brought up in, but afterwards sought the church as it has been in England, and its jewels and gems of the King James Bible, the Book of Common Prayer, and much more. And it's been my experience, as it has been for many other people brought up in recent decades and last century and more, that one has observed the church giving up its jewels and becoming something else. And actually, that irritation I feel from the outside, albeit from the outside at the moment, that irritation I feel about the church hasn't gone away even whilst being outside it. A fear, it comes back to that article that provoked Tom Wright's excellent letter. My fear is constantly the church is not doing what so many of us on the outside would like it to do, which is to be preaching its gospel, to be asserting its truths and its claims. And so when one sees it falling into all of the latest tropes, one just thinks, well, that's another thing gone. It's just like absolutely everything else in the era. Everything in this boring, monotone, ill thought out and shallow dialectic. And I am so, as I say, I'm a disappointed non-adherent.
I don't know if Tom, you can help in any way here, but what I mean, perhaps you could firstly. Some thoughts on what Douglas has shared there about his own journey, but also obviously his disappointment in a way as what he sees the church has become today.
I very much understand that. I remember the late great Bishop Stephen Neal, who I knew maybe 30 years ago. He died at a great age around then, saying that every time he went to a modern Anglican service, he came away with this deep sense of loss because he had grown up, like Douglas, with King James Version and the Book of Common Prayer, and just felt that the contemporary liturgies just didn't cut it. And I get that too. I grew up similarly with very traditional words, etc. I suppose for me, that still remains. I have been able in many contexts to go on using traditional liturgies as well as modern ones. But for me, the essence of it isn't so much the words and the culture and so on. And obviously that's a very English, British, actually English thing, the Book of Common Prayer and the King James Bible. And I've been privileged to know Christians from many, many different backgrounds, many different parts of the world. And particularly when I was Bishop of Durham, I was able to see, we had, 250 parishes in the diocese, very wide range from traditional to modern to this to that. But I was able to see the church at work, the church being the church on the street, the church being the one group to whom the local council could turn to find out what on earth was going on that terrible sink estate or whatever it was. And to see the church actually caring for people, being the family for the familyless, etc. Not all churches do that, but that gave me this wonderful sense that all the theory that I as a theologian knew ought to be happening was happening on the street in some of the places that never hit the news and never hit the newspapers and never get quoted on the radio or whatever. But there are many, many, many ordinary Christians, not that there are ordinary Christians, but you know what I mean, who are simply doing Christianity at ground level. And that's the thing that is so exciting. And I think when you see that, you look across at the new atheists, and it's rather like people who, like Douglas and me, love classical music, overhearing a conversation between people who are tone deaf. You just think, well, it's a great shame for you that you don't get it, because actually this world of music is so rich and amazing. And that's how I feel about the new atheists. It's too bad. And yes, there are arguments, but actually the arguments aren't necessarily the crucial thing. What matters is something else, which many, many people still have. And we talk about post-Christian Britain or Europe, but actually there are many new Christian movements, confusing often, and often getting muddled and so on, as we all do. But there's a great deal to be encouraged by, as well as, and as Douglas knows, I share his frustration when it appears that the church is simply jumping on the latest trendy bandwagon. I mean, one quick example, and then I'll shut up. About 10 years ago, when the debate on women bishops was really getting going, David Cameron in the House of Commons said rather disdainfully about the Church of England, yes, it's time they got on with it. They should get with the program. And I wrote a cross article for the Times to say, no, we are, I hope, going to have women bishops, not because it's the program that our society is moving in some sort of spurious progressive idea, but because right from the beginning, the first person who Jesus told to go and tell other people that he'd been raised from the dead was a woman, that the foundation of the apostolic ministry comes with Mary Magdalene on the day, on Easter day. And from there, it's all downhill. So I totally agree the church shouldn't just be jumping on the agendas. It should be exploring more what is in its own textbook.
Just before we get to that Spectator article that Tom responded to, Douglas, just staying with the new atheism for a moment, because in a sense, arguably, that has been part of the story of how we have, you know, ended up in an increasingly post-Christian West. But I know that you were friends with one of the great new atheists, Christopher Hitchens. So did you disagree with him when you were, you know, having lunch as friends and that sort of thing? What was your relationship with the new atheists? Did you outgrow them? I don't know.
I think I'm friends with all of them. Some still. I remember I knew Chris around the time that I started to lose my own faith, and I had been asked, actually, it was in the Spectator. We always have a Christmas sort of poll of writers, politicians, and others, and ask them a question. And that year, it must have been about 2008, that year the question was, do you believe in the virgin birth? And I think it was the last time I said, certainly in print, maybe the first as well, I said, yes, of course. And I remember I saw Christopher in Washington a little while later. We've known each other for some years. Reviewed a number of my books, and I remember he raised this over a drink in his apartment. He said, I saw your answer in the Spectator. And I thinking, oh gosh. And he said, you could have knocked me over with a feather. I didn't know you. And he sort of said something like, I didn't know you were that way. You know, he was very shocked, very, very shocked. And we agreed not to discuss it at the following lunch. Yes, I mean, I've I've spent my life surrounded by people who have strong opinions, and that includes very religious people of many faiths, and many secularists and atheists. I think there has been, I just alluded to earlier, there's been, I think, a fruitful dialogue in recent years, actually, on this. I would just throw one thing in, if I may, which is that one of the things Tom just said alludes to something I find very interesting, which is a retreat that can happen in faith from faith with assertions, ethical claims, and much more, into effectively a social action group. Now, I know that's not what you were referring to, but I'm very interested in the way that this has happened. I've seen it in America. I've seen it in Jewish communities a lot as well. There's actually a term, I would muck it up if I tried to do it in Hebrew now, but there's a term for effectively the doing of good works. And you can see some effectively, basically, non-believing, no longer believing sort of Jewish communities falling into this, saying, well, actually, our Judaism will be doing good works, doing charity and soup kitchens and much more. And I find that very interesting. I find it noble and much more, but I don't think of it as religion. I don't see it as that.
But that is the problem with our word religion and religious, isn't it? That the modern, as in post-18th century, view of religion is precisely something that is divorced from the rest of ordinary life. And that's been reinforced by, I think, an over or misinterpretation of the idea of justification by faith apart from works, as though, okay, if we believe in faith and that sort of religion, you shouldn't be bothered about all that other stuff at all. Whereas in the New Testament, it's very clear. Paul says on two or three occasions, if you're in this game, be zealous for good works. And he doesn't mean moral good works to earn your salvation or anything like that. It's that from the very start, the church was designed to be an outward facing, what's going on in this community and how can we help kind of movement. And they found that that was shocking to many people because there weren't too many other people in the ancient world who lived like that, who were looking out for the poor, not only their own poor, but other people's as well. Paul says, while we have time, do good to all people, especially those of the household of faith. But there's a sense that following from Jesus himself, there is that agenda that we are about God's plan to put the world right. And we can't do it all ourselves because it's a much bigger thing than that. But we can be people who are bringing about signs of God's restorative justice in the world. And of course, from the outside, that can look like just people running soup kitchens. Well, I'd rather people ran soup kitchens than didn't run soup kitchens, and sure, Douglas would agree. But it's actually about a vision of the whole of life. And if that's why I worry about this word religion and religious, it didn't mean in the first century what it means now either. So I would rather talk about God the creator and God the reconciler and redeemer of creation, focused, of course, on Jesus, but with then the followers of Jesus commissioned to do those things which say to the world, there is a different way to be human. And following Jesus is the key to it.
Yes, if I may say, you're slightly unusual or becoming slightly unusual in this regard, in that you're a theologian, a bishop, and a very prominent faith face in the faith, who does say these things, and this seems to me to be uncommon at the moment, and I what one hears from prominent bishops, archbishops even, is an attempt to slip into the rhetoric of the era and indeed slip into the ethics and the ethical claims of the era without making those foundational assertions that, as I say, I think that many people are hungry for.
This where the issue of the article, let's go to that and put, name that elephant in the room. But Douglas published an article which was highly critical of the Church of England's current approach to anti-racism and so on. Tom, and feeling that they were essentially bowing to a certain woke ideology, essentially, and not sort of doing what they should do as the church. So what was your response to that? And how much truth is there in what in Douglas's concerns about the direction of the
right.
church?
Having since read Douglas's book, The Madness of Crowds, I see more clearly than I did at the time where the energy for Douglas's article was coming from, because clearly Douglas has mapped out, in, as I said before, a rather disturbing way, the large movements often rooted in various forms of early 20th century Marxism, connected with Foucault and people like that, that have then generated some of these great movements. And then to see the church getting on board with that, you think, hang on, what's going on? My initial response was, this is actually a problem that Jesus himself faced. He says at one point that the kingdom of God is breaking in violently, but the men of violence are trying to get in on the act. In other words, there were other people saying it's time for the kingdom of God at the same time as Jesus was. Did that mean that Jesus should give up talking about the kingdom of God? No, it meant he had to go on explaining what he reckoned it did mean, as opposed to what the other people were saying. And so there is bound to be a confusing convergence between a genuine Jesus-following desire to see, for instance, social justice. It's written right across the New Testament that there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, no male and female. And about the point from Acts 17, where Paul says on the Areopagus, hey, God made all people from the same stuff, from the same stock. We belong together. And rather than, and of course, then we get into the trap, which Douglas has written about as well, of the modern idea that we're all identical, including there being no difference between male and female, etc., versus the postmodern idea, which collapses into dozens of different competing identities, each trying to claim the high ground of the victim, et cetera, et cetera. And again, I think Douglas and I are on the same page on this one. But then my point would be that the church, in being true to itself and not simply relying on contemporary, rather shallow ethical maxims, but being true to its original gospel, actually has the makings of doing what at its best some of the woke ideologies are seeking to do, which is a genuine passion for justice. And forget the fact that the Marxists have come in on the act. Of course they have, because if the church misses out half of its agenda, it shouldn't be surprised if other people come rushing in from the side to fill it in. So that's where the issue, I think, has to lie. But I was grateful for what Douglas said, because it seems to me if an elderly theologian has anything to offer to the world, it may be the reminder of some of the deeper, richer stuff which is out there, which is in the Bible, for goodness sake, and which can refresh and renew a vision of what we all should be about.
And we'll be back shortly to see how Douglas Murray responds. You're listening to the live stream show that I hosted between N.T. Wright and Douglas Murray just this last Thursday night, asking how do we live in a post-Christian world? It's part of our big conversation from Unbelievable. We'll be back shortly.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to The Big Conversation from Unbelievable, episode 3 of season 3 today with me, Justin Brierley, bringing you the Douglas Murray and N.T. Wright conversation that happened just this week on our live stream. It's on identity, myth and miracles. And we'll leap back into Douglas responding to what Tom had to say about woke politics and the church needing to find its calling again for seeking true identity and justice in society. Go ahead, Douglas.
Yes, I think this is very important. It gets to another point I've written about Fairmount in recent years, which is, I think you know, Justin, I think maybe when we spoke before, we spoke about this, that sometimes people claim that the sort of public ethics of the time are sort of non-existent. That's not quite true. They're trying to dig down in quite a forceful way at the moment. What I was writing about in that article was just one example of that. But as I think I said to you when we spoke before, what I think of as being the most striking failure of the time is the failure to embed any ethic that does not rely on the Christian ethic in regards to the equality of everyone in the eyes of God. Our age is struggling very badly with an attempt to replace that ethic or find another way to do it. And there are various ways which it's tried to do that. Human rights ideology is one way, fairly developed, but I think not successful. And another is effectively the landing on equity as the answer, when it can't be the answer. But I see what people are struggling to do, which is to try to maintain and hold on to this exceptionally important gift of the Christian inheritance. Without the idea of equality in the eyes of God and the value of every individual in the eyes of God, you are left with these attempts to assert that, for instance, everyone is the same or can be. And it's clear that we can't be and that we aren't. It's one of the great things. If you take away the worry about the loss of the foundation, then it's fine. We can live with it.
I very much see Douglas's point. From where I sit, the only way really to get this sorted is to use a trite phrase, to go back to Jesus, because in the Jesus of the Gospels, as opposed to the Jesus of popular imagination, you find a rigorous re-inhabiting of the entire Jewish tradition and a redirection of this vision of what would it look like if God was in charge. That's the question of the kingdom of God. Just supposing God was in charge, how would it look? Well, it might look like a man who had two sons and one did this and one. It might look like, and then he heals somebody in the crowd, whatever it is. It's a renewal of human beings, not in order to be identikit, we're all equal now, but in order to be certainly equally valued and equally, though uniquely in themselves, part of an ongoing program that God has launched, not human beings at this point. And so when I then come forward into the 20th and 21st centuries with that, I find myself saying, when I was young, we watched traditional morality go out of the window. It was sex in the 60s. It was money in the 80s. You know, we don't need to obey the old rules. We're going to do it differently. We're the modern world now. And then what's happened is the invention of, and I think Douglas and I agree on this, the invention of neo-moralisms, which is what the woke ideology is really all about. And it reminds me sometimes of, I think it was Caligula, the Roman emperor, or it might have been Nero, I'm getting this wrong, it's late at night, who put new laws up so high that nobody could read them and then blamed or punished people for not obeying these new laws that he just invented. And that's very much what's going on at the moment. It's as though society can't live without morality, but if you've banished all the older moralities, you've got to invent some more from the ground up. And we're doing it on a very, very base, very flimsy basis, it seems.
It also goes back to what you mentioned, the David Cameron comment, which is, what exactly is the project? Because there's an added cruelty, isn't there, to as it were, writing the laws in a place where they cannot be read. There's an added cruelty if you haven't even finished writing them yet, and you tell people to get with them. So one of the questions underneath the R era is what exactly are the laws? What are the rules here? The Christian ethic has a set of rules. It's they can be debated around endlessly, as everyone present knows. But that there are foundations to them you cannot deny. They're not wholly abstract. When we don't know.
But the Christian morality, it seems to me, is to do with the goodness of creation but the need for recreation, for redemption and recreation, but a recreation which doesn't say, forget the old ways, we'll do it totally differently. I mean, which is what we've got in a lot of society at the moment. Oh, just don't worry about what everyone used to think. We're going to do it totally differently. We're going to change the meaning of words as well as the meaning of behavior, but rather to say, no, try seeing the world from the perspective of a good and wise creator who is revealed in a thousand ways, whether it's music or beauty or whatever it is, as well as the structures of reality. But this world is out of joint, and the great Jewish vision, and again, I knew and am grieving about Jonathan Sacks, bless him, he saw this so clearly, the great Jewish vision of God's passion for the world to restore the world and the vocation of the people of God to be somehow modeling that and showing it forth and saying, this is a self-evidently good way to be human. And so it isn't just thinking through ethical theory. It's about how the community actually lives. And for me, again, this is all about following and worshiping Jesus. And that was folly to the Greeks and scandalous to the Jews in the first century, and it still is today. But if you put that as the coping stone in the middle, everything else will actually fall into place.
Coming back to you then, Douglas, given that you, to some extent, you're both in agreement on the fact that to lose the Christian story and the moral underpinnings that's given culture leaves everyone scrabbling to kind of essentially invent their own morality, and everyone gets very confused and angry with each other in the process. I mean, where do we go from here, I suppose, is the question. And is there a way back even to you know, what now? It's the genie's sort of out of the bottle, though, isn't it? I mean, can we go back to that once Christian age where apparently everyone more or less agreed on things?
Yes, I say that in The Strange Death of Europe. You can't wish things you know and wish them unknown, or wish them unlearned. And this is something I think is very important in all dialogue between believers and non-believers. I just wanted to say, I wouldn't like it to be anyone to take away from this that I simply think the church has a PR problem. It isn't just that I think that the presentation is wrong, or there's a mistake in, for instance, falling into the religion of anti-racism or anything else. It's that I do believe that doing that means that the church fails to tell its own story. We had an article in The Spectator, I think last week, from my friend, former Bishop Michael Nazir Ali. He made a very powerful point about the figures in the church, for instance, who were profoundly anti-slavery, and not just, Wilberforce, but Charlemagne and others who saints in the 7th century, Christian saints in the 7th century, who were martyred and objected to the slavery in their own time. There is, what I'm trying to say is that it's not just there's a PR misunderstanding, it seems to me, within the church, and it's missing a trick. It is that this is not a fair summary of the Christian story. It isn't a fair summary of the story of the church. And what it is the adoption of a facile and profoundly hostile analysis of the church, which sees the church, for instance, as being a white enterprise. But it clearly isn't. Like Tom Wright, I've seen congregations across the world. I've been at services throughout the Middle East, across Africa. Beleaguered communities sometimes show absolutely extraordinary and inspiring levels of faith. And I don't recognize the negative interpretation of the church, which I see from some people trying to force a different ethic on the church today. But as I say, it's not just in the history of the church, but in the story that the church has to tell about itself today that I think that there is an error being made. Because, for instance, to go back to something which, as Tom Wright knows, I wrote about in The Madness of Crowds, if you look at the great error of the ideology which is trying to embed today, it is that it has spent no time bothering itself over the question of forgiveness. Now, it's not just that I think that the church is missing a PR trick in not addressing this. I think that the church does everybody in society the most enormous disservice if it doesn't say, this is what our faith is built upon. We have been thinking about this and trying to practice it, at least, for millennia. So at least give us your ear for a moment.
Yeah. And that's really important. I was talking to a good friend just this morning on email who has been writing a short article about wokeness, and he wanted me to comment. And I said, the one thing you need to point out is that all the woke morality is simply about you guys are wrong and you guys are wrong and you're full of hate and you're this and you're that. And there is no sense that if you repent, we'll forgive you.
No.
You just have to grovel. And it's a morality of, I hate to use the word Pharisaism because actually that's a slur on the first century Pharisees, but that's what in the popular discourse it's about. It's about we've got this right and we're making up new laws as we go along, as Douglas has said. And you lot are wrong and you're staying wrong and we're glad you're wrong and we're going to rub your noses in the dirt. Mm. And it seems to me that's rather like certain revolutions. I mean, revolutions that eat their own children, where the French Revolution notoriously ended up decapitating quite a lot of people who had been among the leaders of the early movement. And it's more complicated than that.
It strikes me that in everything you've said there, that in a sense, though, just even if we are in a quote-unquote post-Christian world, we're not in a less religious world in the sense that these ideologies become quite religious, but not in a very grace-filled kind of religion. And you've spoken about that yourself, Douglas, that there's that kind of aspect to the way people then grasp certain identities and certain causes and ideologies, and that becomes their sort of their identity, their religion. And I suppose this is the problem, isn't it? We are meaning-seeking, story-driven creatures. And if it's not going to be the story of Christianity, it's going to be another story.
Yes.
And the question is, can we live together with these very different stories which often bump up against each other?
Mm. Yes.
Sorry, Douglas, go ahead and then Tom respond.
Oh, okay. I think this is true. I've often thought, I hesitate to say this in front of such a distinguished theologian, but I've often thought that one of the interesting points about what Jesus teaches is that much of it, as Tom Wright well knows, much of it you can find in some of the contemporary Greek thought. Some of the thought is around the Roman world, but nothing prepares for the demand to love your enemy. It seems to me so completely revolutionary and so completely counterintuitive that it has and I think we recognize, if I may say so, I think we recognize in our era as well, with awe when we see this being practiced. That's why I come back to this, that it's not just about missing a trick, it's missing an opportunity to display your faith. When people see actual forgiveness, it is, I think, among the most humbling, most moving things that you can ever witness as a human being. There was an example a couple of years ago when at a church in the South America, that was very unusual, but appalling crime, when a young white crazed sort of white supremacist of some kind walked into a church and shot some of the worshippers. And the next day there was an interview with, it was a black congregation, and the next day there was an interview with one of the families, and the mother of somebody who just lost her son said that she forgave the killer of her son. I thought this a couple of years ago. I was doing a tour with somebody who became a friend, Cornel West, Professor Cornel West of Harvard, who, by his own definition, is a revolutionary Christian socialist. So we have a lot to disagree about. I was very struck. Cornel always refers to people as brother, brother this, brother that. Some people think it's an annoying tick of his. I rather like it. But I was absolutely bowled over one day when he referred to this shooting. And he said, that brother who went into that church and shot up that congregation. And I was so moved and so amazed that he would refer even to this person who had done this unforgivable thing by any analysis, an unforgivable thing, would still refer to this man as his brother. It seemed to, and it seems to me this is an example of living and displaying a Christian ethic, which, if it was just seen a bit more, would have a profound impression in the world.
I totally agree with Douglas there. And again, I want to stress that the problem with that is that you can't just do it by you and me saying, and no. anyone else who's listening, by the way, you should be going out and getting on with it, though we all should, and it is difficult, but yes. But it can only ultimately become instantiated in a community and in the settled habits of somebody's life when you have at the heart of the faith the story of Jesus going to the cross to defeat the powers of evil. Because without that, then forgiveness is a lovely idea for other people to practice, but too hard for me, as it were. But if Jesus has actually dealt with evil in his death, whatever that means, and you have to have lots of discussions about how that plays out, of course, then who am I to go on actually holding it against this person or that person? And that's why forgiveness then has as its positive side reconciliation. Forgiveness shouldn't just leave you with, as it were, a zero bank balance. It ought then to open the way for reconciliation. Mm-hmm. That's, of course, what Archbishop Desmond Tutu has done so spectacularly. And I know South Africa is still a very difficult and dangerous place. But when I was young, we were all talking about the coming bloodbath in South Africa. And the fact that there wasn't a bloodbath and that there was a peaceful transition of power was largely due to the fact that Tutu and a lot of others were going and praying with leading politicians, reading the Bible with them. And then when the transition happened, having that amazing commission of truth and reconciliation, with white thugs and black thugs confessing their sins, seeking reconciliation. That should still be sending a shockwave around the world, both in Northern Ireland and in the Middle East. Heaven help us what's going on at the moment, and so on and so on. This is the only way to live, ultimately. But you can only even glimpse a chance of doing it if you've got Jesus himself in the middle. I'm sorry to sound like a cracked record, but perhaps you would expect a theologian always to come
it's
back
important.
And talk about Jesus.
It's, if I say so, it comes back to the point. It's the most important thing to do as a theologian and as a Christian. And it is, as I say, it is an enormous relief to hear it.
I mean, well, you say it's an enormous relief there, Douglas. In a sense, for you, obviously, you came to the point where you couldn't believe that this story was literally true, but you miss it. You even described yourself as a Christian atheist. I mean, the culture at large, there's probably a lot of other Douglas Murrays out there, and people perhaps for whom Christianity has never figured in their life. But if Christianity is the story that did work and the stories that we're now telling aren't working and putting us out of joint, can you see any way in which the Christian story, even as a non-Christian, could start to make inroads again? Is it simply about the church standing up again and being a bit more confident?
I'm not sure I said only as confidence. I've said many years that I see an enormous opportunity for people of faith to be speaking into perhaps a more receptive crowd than before. I do see that. I do think, to perhaps the rather hackneyed reference to Matthew Arnold, but I do always think that the interesting thing about the sea of faith is there's no reason why it can't come back in. Yes. The sea doesn't only withdraw. You know, it's the point of tides, but for that to happen, what would be on offer would have to be radically different from everything else in the society that's on offer. That's one of the reasons why I've been very interested. I can't remember if we talked about this with Justin before, but I've been very interested in recent years watching contemporaries of mine who have seen through, looked at, stared at some of the same problems that I have, and have come to conclusions of their own in a religious sense. I've been very struck, for instance, by not a large number of people, a relatively small number of people, but people I think of as being very intelligent thinking people who have, for instance, converted to Catholicism. And I see, I can think of one person who is an Anglican, one person who was born and brought up a Muslim, and somebody else I know who was an atheist throughout. And I don't think this is typical by any means. I'm not trying to say that. I'm just saying that among people I know who are very thoughtful, who thought about these things, have come from a wide range of different directions. They have gone towards that. And what has struck me most is that they have gone to the most traditional form of that faith. I'm talking about people who've gone into Tridentine mass attending Catholicism. They don't go to the weaker forms of it because they want to drink as directly from the well as they can.
Yes.
And that seems to me to be, as I say, why it saddens me to put it no stronger, that a religion with this inheritance, with all of this to offer, would offer the most watered down version of itself, to the extent that it is a version that is indistinguishable from everything else on offer in society.
Yes, I very much understand that. I think at the same time, there is a sense which is deeply rooted in Jesus himself going and eating with sinners, doing things that nobody was expecting a Messiah, a prophet to do, breaking the social taboos in order to be on all fours with the people who really needed him. There was the shock that went through the system with that, but that's happened again and again throughout Christian history, that Christianity is a missionary religion, and missionaries find that they do their work better when they're actually on all fours with the people that they're trying to get to know, and not, as it were, saying, here is this amazing, unattainable ideal, and I'm up there somewhere, and maybe you could find your way up if you're lucky, because that's how it sometimes comes across to people. And so there's this tension the whole time between that wonderful, rich thing, as you say, drinking from the well itself, which, of course, for me is what I think both reading the Bible, saying my prayers, going to ordinary worship services, that's what it's all about. It's absolutely central. But there is a to and a fro. And again, it's because of a belief in the goodness of God's creation that that actually these people out there are created by God. God loves them. And I am called to love them as well and to get alongside them and not, as it would appear to some, hold myself away from them by going to something so recondite that the average mortal would never even have the slightest idea what it was all about. There is, I think that tension is always going to be there.
Well, if I may say so, just very quickly on this, I completely agree, but a very interesting thing that's happening at the moment is that the abstract not getting involved in the nitty-gritty of your era is actually what is happening mistakenly. We ran a piece just this week. I don't want to keep plugging The Spectator, but we ran a piece just in the new edition out this week by a very intelligent young clergyman, talking about, just saying, look, the latest, again, I also don't want to spend the whole time bashing the Church of England, but he said the latest thing this week is an edict on church memorials, and there is going to be an expectation of that memorials in churches across England that are connected with, for instance, the most obvious one is slavery, will have to be reconsidered. And this clergyman just says, I was so moved by it. He said, I have four churches that I oversee. If I am to spend my time going through this, he said, first of all, no one has ever complained about a memorial ever to me. He said, if I'm to spend my time doing this, I will not be able to spend my time ministering to the people in my parishes. So it is as straightforward as that. And as I say, what strikes me is that there is a drive for what is mistakenly thought to be a drive that will satisfy and impress people in the era, when in fact it will take the church precisely away from its activities.
Yeah,
it seems to me an example of a massive misunderstanding of where the church's priorities ought to be in order to impress the rest of the country.
Fascinating conversation. Time is slipping by so fast, though, and I did promise those who are watching on YouTube and Facebook some opportunity to ask questions. We had a lot of them coming in. Keep them coming, by the way. If you'd like to ask a question, you can do so in the chat on wherever you're watching on Facebook or on YouTube. And just before we come to some of these questions, just a reminder that if you'd like to take part in our survey, tell us what you thought of today's show. You can find the link in the info with today's video. We'd love you to click through to that. Tell us what you think of today's program. You can find more from The Big Conversation by going to thebigconversation.show. If you sign up, you'll get updates, bonus content, and more videos from this series and previous ones. And if you want to continue the conversation, N.T. Wright, one of our guests today, will be speaking at Unbelievable, the conference, this Saturday, the 15th of May. It's all online. You can attend from anywhere in the world. Unbelievable.live. Our theme is how to tell the greatest story ever told. Very much links to what we've been talking today about. How do we rediscover the story that has shaped previous generations? Can that story be told afresh for a new generation in a world where many people don't know what their story is anymore? Well, we'll be back shortly with the questions that came in from the watching audience. You're listening to The Big Conversation from Unbelievable. This program is sponsored by ADF International. Visit protectfreespeech.uk.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the third and final part of this week's edition of the show, bringing you the conversation between N.T. Wright and Douglas Murray that featured as our third episode of this season of The Big Conversation. Coming up after today's show, tonight on The Profile, you can hear Roz Picard. She was actually featured in our last edition of The Big Conversation, in conversation with Nick Bostrom on AI, God and the future of humanity. Well, she's been sitting down with Ruth Jackson to tell her story at more length. She's an AI expert at MIT in effective computing. She'll be talking about her own Christian conversion, how her faith relates to her work in technology. Look out for that on The Profile tonight at 8 p.m. and on The Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. Next week on this show, a few highlights from this year's conference, which of course is taking place Saturday, the 15th of May, this very weekend. So look out for that on your podcast or on your radio show, same time next week. Not featuring much of your feedback this week because we're going long with our conversation today, but just a few brief comments from YouTube that came in on the back of our live stream. Camille said, splendid conversation, run so smoothly and respectfully. Wish we had more of such intellectually honest people expressing honestly their point of view. Justin did a good job moderating it proficiently and professionally. Thank you very much, Camille. Denali said, N.T. Wright being one of my favourite theologians and Murray one of my most inspiring authors, I was downright giddy waiting for this discussion. Thank you. And Jonathan said, great programme. Two great and articulate thinkers of our time. Thank you very much. Glad you enjoyed it. I'm sure there'll be lots more feedback for next week to bring you, and indeed to other shows as well. But for now, let's leap back into this discussion on identity, myth and miracles. Do we need a new story to live by in a post-Christian world, we were asking, with N.T. Wright and Douglas Murray. And let's go to some of your questions. Let's put this first question to you first of all, Douglas, and I'll invite you both to be brief if you can, because there's a lot of questions you would like to get through. So maybe just a couple of minutes each on each of these. But Dylan asks, Douglas and N.T. Wright agree on the importance of the Christian story, but does it matter if it's not true? Douglas, how about you start on this one?
Well, obviously it matters. It matters a huge amount. There is a complex corner, which I'm obviously at, which is whether you can, whether it is possible, and I'm not dogmatic on this question, but whether it is possible to keep what you need without holding on to the idea of it being true. Now, of course, what we mean by true in this context is very complex. Let's just park that for the moment. I think there is an enormous temptation which sits at the moment. It's many people have written about it. I mean, the person I think of most clearly is Schopenhauer in the Dialogue on Religion, who writes in a fascinating way about the possibility that it is, as it were, the philosophy for the masses. I think this is a temptation to follow this idea. I also think, obviously, for any believer, it's a great error, because it's the whole thing is a form of shadow play. And I think myself that the answer isn't clear. How could it be, perhaps? But The question that I think it was the German jurist Bockenforder who put the dilemma out. I first came across this in the writings of Ratzinger, Pope Benedict. Bockenforder's dilemma is: can we maintain an ethical and more structure without the roots that gave it birth? And many people think that the conclusion is already in on that, and that the answer is no. I don't know, because I think that we're currently living through an attempt at that experiment. It's like the question of, you know, exactly where the fire stops and where the heat begins, and when you know where you're living in the embers, and whether you know whether you can get them going again. It's exceptionally hard to know because you're living through it.
Tom, you would expect me probably to quote St. Paul, if the Messiah is not raised, your faith is futile and we're still in our sins. You know, it's pretty basic that there is stuff that happened that was unexpected, that was dramatic, that you couldn't actually have made up. Anyone 30 years, 60 years later than Jesus wouldn't have made it up like that. We know a lot about the sort of stories that they lived on, and this kind of breaks the boundaries. That doesn't in itself mean that it's true, but it does mean that if you put that in the middle, you can see how everything else makes the sense it makes around it. I mean, I was just thinking as Douglas was talking, saying, could we have all the benefits, as it were, without it being true? It's rather like saying all the things that I most value about having been married for nearly 50 years now. Supposing my wife didn't exist, but I could still have a lovely home and well-cooked meals, et cetera, would that be all right? And the answer is, of course not, because it's all about her and being with her and together with her. And Christianity is all about Jesus. It isn't Jesus so that we can have something else, a nice system of how to live. It's we have Jesus, and because we have Jesus, then all the other things make sense. So if you take Jesus away, and that means Jesus being crucified and raised from the dead, then I'm sorry, it's just not going to work. Theologians and others have tried to do without the resurrection in the last century, and their systems basically fail, in my view. And the churches that follow those, I think, have often proved that point as well. So, nice try, no cigar would be my sense.
Yes, but this is the bit where you end up feeling embarrassed in front of Christopher Hitchens, isn't it? If you're required to believe in these things like miracles, and specifically the core miracle at the heart of Christianity. And here's another question, and see what you think of this, Douglas. Bensonium asks, when it comes to Douglas losing his faith, was it those intellectual difficulties in miracles, the virgin birth, or something else? And I suppose I could ask about the resurrection as well. I mean, Tom obviously feels if Christianity is ultimately going to be helpful, it's helpful on the basis that something really happened that changes the world, changes people, and then works out from there. I mean,
yes.
What's your take on that? If you're not really sure that you can go down that resurrection route,
well, let me just argue something slightly counter to what I just said, but doesn't completely counter it, but it might complement it. I remember some years ago reading a very interesting a book by George Steiner, in which he relayed a conversation he said was one of the most important conversations he had in his life, which was actually in South Africa, which Tom just referred to. I hope I don't get it wrong. It's in one of his later books. But Steiner says that late one night over dinner, he's talking with some activists, happen to be black activists, and I suppose this must have been still in apartheid time. And one of them says to him suddenly, to Steiner, who's obviously Jewish, but you don't understand, we don't have a book. And Steiner said it was one of the most flooring and distressing things he had ever heard. We don't have a book. Now, obviously, these people were not Christian. But what they noticed was they did not have a thing to draw upon in the same way that, for instance, Steiner, although he wasn't exactly a believing a Jew, I think, had the Torah. There's a similar point made by Alan Bloom in one of his books in the 1980s. I can't remember which one, where he says, if you're not going to have the Bible, you would need to have a book of equivalent seriousness to base it all on. And I've always thought this is a very important challenge, because there are books that people might put forward, try to base it on, but they are never of equivalent seriousness. And it's actually quite hard to think of a book of equivalent seriousness to the Bible. But I do think this is a challenge. What would you base it all on?
Exactly. And it's fascinating because A.C. Grayling, maybe 10 years ago, produced that thing called The Good Book, which was his attempt to do a sort of secular Bible, and it fell flat on its face.
Yeah.
It was a very shallow and rather distressing production. But the Christian, the point of the Christian Bible is, yes, it's a book which does this, that, and the other. It's a great story, but the Christian Bible, the climax of the story is, of course, Jesus. The four Gospels bring the story of Israel to an unexpected and very shocking climax, as a result of which all sorts of other things happen. So it isn't that the Bible is just full of abstract teachings and ethics, etc., and, oh, yeah, we've got this book which tells us what to do. It's a story, and you're invited to get on board with the story and to be part of the onward movement that takes it forward from there. And in a sense, the Jewish Bible does the same thing, but in a much more wistful way, because it's telling a story, but the story sort of, well, does it peter out, or does it turn into something abstract? That's a question which Jews wrestle with to this day. But the Christian Bible has that climax on Jesus. And if you take that away, well, it's a lovely idea, but why should we credit it?
Yeah, I mean, Douglas, just coming back on that, and there's a question that maps ties into this a bit, from Alex, who asks you, Douglas, would you consider yourself a moral realist? I suppose the question I want to ask along with that is, do you consider there is a story that we're supposed to be living by? I.e., is there something that transcends us? Is there a purpose? Is there a morality? Is there a something to which we are beholden? Because in a sense, that idea has gone away in a postmodern world, in a new atheist world. You know,
it,
life is whatever you make it. There really is no overarching purpose, no meta-narrative. Yeah. Christianity obviously gave people that and continues to give many people that. A story, as Tom says, to live into. But we don't seem to have those kinds of stories anymore. So where do you find yourself, and are you worried at the lack of this kind of a story now?
Well, I've said before, I can't remember where, that I we're clearly, as I think has been mentioned, we're meaning-seeking beings, we're storytelling beings. That having been agreed, the question then is, are we just meaning-seeking beings, or are we meaning-seeking beings and there's meaning? Now, I happen to incline more to the latter position. I don't know exactly what it is, but my inclination goes that way, and it's partly because I think that, and I don't want to get too abstract here, but there are things that you can read even in non-religious texts which strike you as true. I was reading Brothers Karamazov recently, and of course Dostoevsky's seeped in Christian religion, but there are two moments at least in that book where you gasp, because what Dostoevsky is doing is suddenly taking the story into an entirely other realm. You'll know if you read it, that there's a moment when you realize that one of the characters believes he is being visited by the devil. And the moment in which he says to his brother, "How did you know he visits me?" is unbelievably powerful. It knocked me over when I read it, because Dostoevsky is doing something that seems to me is accurate in our understanding of our lives, which is that we go through them, we act in them as if that is all, and we stumble at strange moments on things that suggest to us that it's not all. And this is an intimation. I say that, I mean, this is why aesthetics is important to me, it's why music is important to me, why poetry and art is important to me, because I don't think it's doing something just on its own. I think it's giving us a sign of something. I think that it's what's so extraordinarily important about music, is that music tells us something that exists in the language we cannot completely speak, but which we know is inviting us towards something which we understand to be true. I could go on all day about this, but yes, that's my in short.
It sounds very similar to what you've been talking about in your latest book, Broken Signpost, Tom, that all of these things that speak somehow to our soul are a, as you say, broken signpost towards something beyond them.
Yes, that the language of beauty, and for me, music particularly, is enormously powerful, and it's pointing towards something, but then the music stops, or the sunset fades, or the beautiful friend is killed in a car crash or whatever, and it looks as though then we're back with Jean-Paul Sartre and say life is just a sick joke. And that's where so much of our culture has been. Yeah, it was nice stuff, but it doesn't actually mean anything. And for me, it's only, again, cracked record coming up, it's only when you put the story of Jesus in the middle of that and discover that Jesus and his crucifixion are the kind of ultimate broken signpost, because that's where we see justice denied, beauty trampled on, freedom obliterated, etc. All those things which were our great dreams, which we have lost, are actually true of the story of Jesus going to the cross. And I would urge anyone to reread the story of Jesus going to the cross, thinking of it like that, not just then this happened, then that happened, but those great things that we love, beauty, freedom, spirituality, all of these great ennobling things, they're all there in that story. And Jesus himself, as God incarnate, comes to the place where our dreams let us down, in order to be there with us and then to do the new creation thing out the other side. That's a summary of a much more complicated argument, but that's where it's going.
By the way, there's one other point worth throwing out there, which is that there is another signpost, as it were, which is that it is actually exceptionally hard to live as a nihilist.
To live as a nihilist. A nihilist, yes.
It's a very interesting thing. Nihilism is spoken about a lot. People quite often describe particular ages as being nihilistic. But in fact, it is very rare to come across an actual nihilist.
Yes.
Almost nobody lives in that state. In the modern era, I can think of probably only one person who pretty much approximates it, which is Michel Houellebecq, the French novelist, who certainly writes as a nihilist. But even he, you get the sense, and sorry, Justin, if I've said this before, I can't remember, you get the sense is not completely capable of living as a nihilist either. If I'm giving a quick example, there's an extraordinarily disturbing, sorry, I know we said we'd do 2 minutes with each question.
It's fine. Go ahead.
There's an extraordinary moment in a book by one of the surviving journalists from the Charlie Hebdo offices, who wrote a book called Disturbance a couple of years ago, a very, very upsetting book. But he described bumping into Michel Houellebecq at a party sometime after the massacre. And he recognizes him, and Michel Houellebecq had never met him before. They've both got bodyguards at this party. And Houellebecq sees the still very, very visibly wounded journalist come in, and they stand opposite each other for a moment in this terrible moment of recognition. And Michel Houellebecq quotes, I believe it's the Gospel of St. Matthew. He says in French to the journalist, he says, men of violence take it by force, and then leaves. It suggests to me that in Houellebecq's head, it isn't entirely nihilism either.
That even then, and who knows where that came from, a bit of memory of French Catholicism or whatever, phrases that did actually give meaning. And that's a Jesus phrase. Yeah. My favorite novel by the Jewish novelist Chaim Potok is My Name is Asher Lev, where the young rabbinic student who discovers he's got an amazing gift for painting, which is not something that his rabbinic community wants to know about at all, is trying to find models for the pain of being a Jew in the modern world. And he travels from New York to Europe, and he goes around the galleries, and he comes back and he paints crucifixions. And obviously there's a lot of kind of Chagall and so on in the background of that. But part of the grasp of that is a sense of, even in an ultra-Orthodox community where the idea of a cross on the corner outside a church in a street somewhere would mean those are the people who think that we're God killers or whatever. So there's a real fear. Nevertheless, nothing but the crucifixion would do to express what he needed to express. And it's almost as though it's now woven in not just to culture, but the way that the human race is, that at the very moment when it tries to get away from all that traditional Christianity stuff, the best model with which to do it turns out to be something pretty central to what the Christian gospel was all about.
I've got an interesting question here from Carla. We'll start with you, Tom, as she asks this specifically of you. In a postmodern world, are you concerned that our use of the word story has a worldview confusion with myth instead of truth? In postmodernism, everything is story slash myth. Do we need to distinguish Christian truth from story slash myth? What do you say?
Yeah, this is obviously a much more complicated thing than we got time to address, because there's at least four or five different senses of the word myth which have been out there. In the popular discourse, it just means a story about something which we know didn't happen. That's a very low grade meaning of myth, so we can park that. But I would say it's one of the strengths of postmodernity that it has highlighted the ineradicable nature of story within human life. So there was a kind of a modernist rationalism which imagined you could reduce everything to propositions, and that stories were just kids' stuff to entertain the masses while the real philosophers got on with the hard-edged propositions. And I think we now all know, and this is one of the good things about postmodernity, that yes, we live on stories, but the fact that it is a story then does raise the question, but did it happen? It's the question which comes up in a court of law the whole time. It's no good standing there as a witness and saying, let me tell you a story, once upon a time, da-da-da-da, because the judge wants to know and the jury wants to know, but did it happen? And you can rank stories according to the apparent intention of the storyteller. Is this a story which was designed? I mean, take Jesus' parables. It makes no sense to say of the parable of the prodigal son, but what was the father's name? Or what did the mother say when they came back? Or which bit of the farm did he then own? That misses the point as a matter of genre. But if you take Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, actually, it would miss the point of those stories to say, they were just spinning these fantasy narratives like sort of Pilgrim's Progress or something out of thin air. No, Luke is very particular about this. Let me give you the dates. It was in the reign of so-and-so, and so-and-so was the high priest, and this, that, and the other. This is stuff that happened. And the point is, the happenedness of it has changed the world. And I'm back to something Douglas said half an hour ago. We have sold ourselves short in Western Christianity because we don't know the true story of church history and all the great stuff that has happened. And we have believed the Enlightenment lie that Christianity was just part of the problem rather than part of the solution all along. That's a whole other topic. But so I want to say, yes, beware of story collapsing into myth. Know what the different kinds of stories are and how they work.
I mean, we don't have time to pursue it, Douglas, today, but maybe another conversation to have at some point would be the fact that I think part of your deconversion, for want of a better word, was to do with coming to doubt the reliability of the Bible and whether it was actually based on historical facts, and obviously the miraculous nature of it as well. But do you feel like if you could be shown sort of the factuality of it, as well as the way it makes sense of our culture and everything else, that would, I guess, be the missing piece for you that would take you back in some sense, to a new kind of faith?
It's too complex to say what the missing piece would be or could be, and it would be presumptuous of me to try to explain it or suggest it, let alone know it, actually. I would just duck that by making an observation on one thing that just came up, which is of all the different understandings of myth, even the least deep understanding of myth, it still irritates me when you hear the phrase "only a myth."
Exactly.
An extraordinarily facile phrase, which is in far too common a use. The Metamorphoses of Ovid are not history. They're not only a story.
Yeah. But this was the point that grasped C.S. Lewis, wasn't it? That he had thought that all this stuff was just myth, and then he turned a corner and realized, oh my goodness, looks like this great myth actually happened once.
Yes.
The Dying and Rising Corn King or whatever it was.
Mm.
And made that discovery in the company of a great storyteller himself, J.R.R. Tolkien. Of course.
Tolkien, yes.
And in that sense, there is this idea that these great myth stories, you know, they are, you know, Lord of the Rings is arguably drenched in a kind of Christological overtones, and that these are the stories that seem to compel us and grab us and so on. And in that sense, as time is drawing to a close, Douglas, I suppose, you know, you've been so very gracious, because a lot of these have been very personal sort of questions about faith and that kind of thing. But do you wish for it to be true? Do you wish that there was that, as Lewis said, this is the true myth? Is that something that you could see making sense of the world if there was a true story that everything sort of came
of course. I don't really understand people who are don't wish it to be true. I don't really understand those people. I do have known some. We mentioned one earlier who don't wish it to be true. Didn't wish it to be true. No, of course I do. I suppose that one thing that I've always found extremely powerful in that regard is whenever I've been in the Holy Land, Israel, surrounding area. I never forget one of the first times I was there. I think during 2006 conflict in Lebanon, and I was speaking to. I happened to stop one day, and there was a church that was being built. And it's quite unusual to need a new church in that neck of the woods, but one was being built for various reasons. And I asked the person who was in charge that day. I said, "By the way, what's the name of the church?" And he said, "It's the Church of the Transfiguration." And I said, "Beautiful. How did you decide to do that?" And he said, "Well, here we name churches after the nearest site, and the Transfiguration happened there." And he pointed to the mountain beside us. And wherever in the world you're brought up as a Christian, it makes an enormous impact on when you see the physical sites. I've traveled around there a lot, and I don't think for me anything quite equals that in terms of making an impact on me. I think, you know, what we aren't transparent to ourselves, and I'm not transparent to myself, and I have no idea how to answer that question.
Well, you've answered a great many questions very helpfully and as honestly as you can, Douglas. Thank you very much for the time this evening. Thanks for all the questions that have come in as well on Facebook and YouTube as well. Any final thoughts, Tom, that you'd like to leave us with as we close out our discussion?
I was fascinated by what Douglas just said about the Transfiguration. I have been on one or two mountains which claim to be the site of the Transfiguration, Mount Hermon, Mount Tabor, etc. Yeah. For me, one of the most moving moments in my life was on Good Friday 1989, when for the first time I went into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem and spent most of the day there just contemplating, this is where it happened. And when you're actually there, it doesn't seem odd that the hopes and fears of all the years, or if you like, the pain and tears of all the years, should be focused on one place. And I intuited that, I felt it, and I thought it theologically. And in a sense, that was, you know, it didn't teach me anything I didn't sort of vaguely know already. But the concreteness of it is so striking there. It's not just an idea in people's heads going around the world. This is stuff that actually happened, as a result of which the world is a different place. The world is claimed by God in his kingdom as a result of those facts.
as we close, it reminds me of something you said the last time you came on the show, Douglas, that you had an experience at Galilee where it made you feel something happened here, was the way you put it.
Yes, yeah. I think that's right. Yes. Yeah. I think it's very hard to come away from there without thinking about it.
Thank you so much for tonight's conversation. It's been a real joy and a pleasure. I wish we could have gone on longer, but our time is over. Perhaps we can do it again at some point in the future. But for now, thank you very much, Douglas Murray and N.T. Wright, for being my guests on tonight's big conversation. By the way, we'd love you to tell us what you thought of tonight's show. We've got a survey, which you can find in the info with today's video. Just click on it. Multi-choice, very quick. And we'd love to hear what you made of the show. Do make sure to follow The Big Conversation at thebigconversation.show. Sign up there for bonus content, updates, and of course, all the rest of the shows that are coming as well in this season. And if you want more from N.T. Wright, and indeed, he'll be in dialogue on these kinds of issues with Tom Holland, among other people, then do get along to our Unbelievable conference this Saturday, the 15th of May. You don't have to leave your home, though, to do that. Unbelievable.live. It's all online, and it's going to be a wonderful day of thinking through some of these big ideas. That's unbelievable.live. And all of the links are in the show notes today. For now, all that remains for me to say is thank you, Douglas, and thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
And hope we'll see each other again at some point. Thank you.
Very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on today's edition of the show. Again, the survey with the show details, if you want to fill that out, we'd love to hear what you made of the show. But you can also email your feedback to me as well, the usual way, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And of course, you can follow and comment on social media as well, at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. If you want to get us on Facebook, you can find us on Instagram, TikTok, and other places as well. Make sure, of course, that you're signed up for more of these conversations, thebigconversation.show. Our next big conversation in a few weeks' time is on the universe. And, well, was it made for us? Luke Barnes and Sabina Hossenfelder debating the fine-tuning of the cosmos. As I say, that's in a few weeks for our next edition of The Big Conversation. For now, thank you so much for being with us. Let me tell you what's coming up next week. Well, we'll be hearing some highlights from our 2021 conference, which is taking place this weekend, Saturday the 15th of May. If you're listening in time, still not too late to register and get along. We'll be keeping the ticketing open right through the day of the conference itself if you just want to leap on and join us on our Zoom conference and in our fabulous 3D resource hub that we've made available as well. This is quite something of a first. But you'll be hearing some of the content from the conference on next week's show, but you can get all of the conference to play back at your own leisure if you are a premium ticket holder or if you want to just purchase the conference afterwards. So all of the details will be made available as well next week. But for now, thank you so much for being with us this week. See you next time.